Hey, welcome to Longform Podcast. I am Max Linsky. I'm here with Evan Ratliff and Aaron Limmer. How you guys doing?
You were out in San Francisco this week, no, Evan?
That is correct. I was out for Pop-Up Magazine, a live magazine, live show with Beck.
I'm sure it was great.
Was?
Who did you talk to when you were in San Francisco?
I talked to Matt Honan of Wired Magazine and Wired.com, and you probably know Matt from the fact that he got hacked, and he wrote a big story about it, and but he's written a lot of other stuff too, and he has an interesting background, and he's funny, so I think people will enjoy listening to him.
If you think people would enjoy listening to you, you might want to start an email newsletter, possibly through Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. They are our sponsors, and we thank them.
Here's Evan and Matt.
Hey, Matt.
Hello.
We're live on air.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon to you. The first thing I have to say is you look really fit right now.
I've lost 10 pounds since you saw me last.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What's happening? I remember when you were at Gizmodo, you had a thing where you were using the Fitbit or some technology thing.
But I was using a lot of it. So here's what I found as I've gotten older is that like it doesn't really matter how much you exercise as much if you aren't on some sort of diet in terms of weight loss, at least for me personally.
I don't want to hear that. That's not something that I'm ready to hear.
Yeah, it's true. I'm sorry.
I'm still like doing slow jogging.
Yeah.
As my answer to everything.
So yeah, so I've been on a diet for about a month and a half now.
Well, it's working.
Thank you.
Like it. So there's a lot of things I want to talk about. I think because this is the long form podcast and because it was such a big thing pretty recently, I feel like the natural place to start is just with the hacking story.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like starting at the end or starting in the middle. We'll get back to some other, how you kind of got to that point. But we were just talking about a little bit before we started, like the implications of it. But a lot of people will know that story. I mean, people will know you from now seeing you on TV, talking about it. Like Wired and other places have done stories like how not to become Matt Honan, basically.
A little embarrassing. Yeah.
So I just want to hear the first, I know it's in the story, but just tell me again the first thing that happened that sort of set that whole thing off.
The very first thing was my phone turning off, basically. So mm-hmm. I had just gotten home and was playing with my daughter, and my phone, a friend of mine had called, and I was like, hey, I just got home. Let me call you back in a minute. My phone turned off, and I thought the battery was dead or something, and so I went and plugged it in, and when I plugged it in, because I was expecting him to call back, or I was going to call him back, I don't remember. Anyway, I went and plugged it in, and when I did, the screen showed that that same screen that you see when you first get a new iPhone and start to set it up with the, you know, the symbol that's sort of the international plug this into iTunes. It's like, you know, restore from backup or set up as new phone. I was like, mm-hmm. what? And so I entered my password to restore it from an iCloud backup. And I just thought the phone had crashed at this point. I thought, like, you know, things happen. And I entered my password, and it said it was wrong. And again, I just thought, like, all right, well, you know, this is dumb. I'll just go and I'll hook it up to my computer and restore it from the backup on my computer. But when I opened my computer, it only showed like a normal screen for a fraction of a second. And mm-hmm. when it did, an alert popped up that said my Google Calendar password was wrong. And that sort of took me aback a little bit. And then the screen went gray and asked for a 4-digit PIN and said that there was a remote wipe in progress. And to stop it, I needed to enter this PIN number, which I didn't have. I had an iPad in my bag. I pulled it out, and I saw it was also in the same remote setup state. Immediately, I was like, oh, shoot. Something's bad. Something bad is going on, and I need to figure out what it is.
It's an incredible narrative of sort of like what happens to you after that moment. But what I'm interested in is what was the moment in this where you said, this is a good story? Because I'm sure you had like a whole bunch of oh shit moments and your pictures are gone and all the things. But was there a moment where you said like, oh, wait, I'm going to write about this?
Right away, one of the things that happened was that, you know, I had been at Gizmodo before I was at Wired. And I don't even know if you can still do this, but you used to be able to log into multiple accounts and link them on the web, on Twitter. And so you wouldn't have to sign in and out again. You know, you could just swap accounts. And so I had a Gizmodo login on my account. And so one of the things that they had done was the whole point for hacking me, for like deleting my hard drive and all that stuff, was to actually just keep me locked out of my Twitter account, which they only wanted because it was a 3-character Twitter handle. It was just for, you know, it was just for kicks.
Yeah, your MAT.
Yeah, Twitter, it was just, it was, there was no like real, you know, nefarious motive for deleting my Google account and all this stuff, other than just to like keep me from being able to get back in. But when they had my Twitter account, they immediately started posting all this racist, like homophobic, nasty stuff. And they also saw that they could get into the Gizmodo account from there, and which had, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions, I have no idea, followers, and started doing the same thing on there. So I immediately, like once I was able to get back online again using a neighbor's computer and like sort of get things figured out, and that was at like 9 o'clock that night. This has been going on for several hours. I felt like I had to address that, because not only had it sullied my reputation, it had sullied Gizmodo's. So I wrote about it right away on Tumblr, just to sort of address what had happened. Yes, I'd gotten hacked, and I sort of speculated about how it had it might have happened. The hackers saw that and corrected me and said, no, that's not how it happened. And when they kind of began to scribe, I asked, it was initially, I think it was sort of a bragging type of thing, you know? And when I sort of understood that it happened, because it wasn't like they had brute forced my password or done some elaborate thing, but that it was a social engineering trick, I immediately kind of thought that it might have like bigger, wider implications. Mm-hmm. And wanted to, at that point, sort of step back, and I thought it would be a good story, you know. Mm-hmm. and like write about how it was done and how they managed to do this, because they had so totally owned me. Like they had gotten my, I didn't know this immediately, but I knew immediately they had gotten into my Twitter, Apple, and Google accounts. I didn't know, they'd also, it turned out, had gotten into my Amazon account, which is the gateway to everything else. But right. You know, and so I knew that somebody could do some sort of social engineering trick where they could get into all three of those systems, that it had to be, you know, it had to be pretty interesting.
Yeah. And then what did the sort of story process unfold from there? Because you were writing, you wrote some online, and then you folded it into a magazine.
Yeah. So I'd written like an initial post just on my Tumblr, just sort of say, hey, I was hacked. This is not me posting all this stuff, which went to the top of Hacker News, or up, or was very high on Hacker News, which I should say, if people aren't familiar, it's not like Hacker News is not like a news site about hacking. It's a technology,
yeah,
news,
it's
site.
Like tech news, yeah.
That had already generated a lot of interest, and over the weekend I started talking to one of these two hackers, these kids, you know, and we started messaging each other on Twitter, then AIM, and then email, and you know, he told me a few things, and then he sort of got a little bit reluctant, was like, I don't think I should tell you anything, you know, wait a second, what am I doing here talking to this guy, telling him what's going on? And I said basically, like, look, if you tell me how you did it, I promise you I won't file any charges. I never have, you know, I won't file any charges. I've actually had law enforcement agencies get in touch with me and say, would you? And I didn't.
Oh, really? Federal, yeah, or local?
I don't know how much I can say about that, actually, yeah. You know, I mean, but certainly, you know, it's contacted by more than one agency. I'll say that. It was high profile. So I wasn't going to, you know, I sort of assured him that I was going to treat it as a reporter, not as a victim. And so he walked me through how everything had happened. And then over the weekend, I was able to confirm some of that with Amazon and Apple by calling their tech support.
Yeah, you guys tried it, right?
Well, first Apple told me, like, first when I called Apple's tech support, the guy who I talked to told me when the call had been placed in my account, and so I was able to confirm the call had been placed, and, like, you know, how it had, or at the time, you know, that the hacker said he had called, you know, mm-hmm. times matched. Hacker told me he talked to a woman, tech support guy told me it was a woman who took the call, you know, I mean, there's stuff like that just matched up. So I was able to say, okay, well, that's, you know, that's right. And then we tried it. We tried it on our own accounts. So we tried the Amazon part. Basically, they're calling Amazon, and it's kind of complicated, but they're adding a credit card number to an account and then calling back and saying, here's my credit card number on my account, can you reset my password? Mm-hmm. Or give me a temporary password, which I think is all they did, and something like that. And so we were able to do that. We were able to do both of those things, and we tried it on multiple Apple accounts because we wanted to make sure it wasn't a fluke. I also wound up speaking with some people inside of inside of some tech support.
Sources.
Call centers, yeah, sources who were able to basically confirm to me that this is how this works. And, mm-hmm. and so at that point, we felt like we had everything really solid, and we published a story on, I believe at the end of the day that Monday, this happened on a Friday, on Wired.com, that was, that sort of ran through, step by step, here's how it happened, and, here are the steps they took,
Did you feel at that point you were already in it and you're like, I'm going to tell this story? Did you have any moments of hesitation where you're kind of like, wait a minute, I'm going to be out front of this thing. This is going to be a story about you, and it's going to either make you more of a target or be embarrassing in some way to have to tell the story?
I knew from the get-go it was going to be embarrassing. The thing I wrote on Tumblr before I wrote it, one of the things that I copped to was not having any backups, both on Tumblr and on that initial story on the web. And I knew I was going to take a lot of grief for that, but I didn't necessarily have much hesitation about doing it. I didn't really care. It was embarrassing. It was embarrassing. I'm a technology journalist. I should have backups, and it was embarrassing to sort of say, okay, yeah, I just got owned like that, But I also thought it was significant and interesting,
mm-hmm.
and so I didn't really care about being embarrassed that much. What I did care about was that and I hadn't realized to the extent that it was going to put me out in front and sort of being a target again.
Mm-hmm.
And so for weeks after that first story popped up, I was getting like all kinds of like weird password probing things happening to my accounts. And I still do on occasion, I'm still like really, really, really deeply paranoid about getting hacked. And like, I still have a little bit of I'm still a little bit fearful of being too open about what's going on with my accounts or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
or saying too much about, what systems I use and things like that. I'm still kind of paranoid, and I still like almost even have like a little bit of like, I mean, I don't want to say PTSD, because I think it's a lot more serious one I've got, but I still like anytime my phone crashes, anytime my computer crashes and that stuff happens, I completely freak out.
Yeah. Well, there's also, there's such access to some things that are so personal. You write about that the photos of your daughter, were lost, and it's not just that those things are lost, but it's also that these people you don't know or somewhere else remotely have like access to knowledge about you and your family. And
yeah, it's very troubling, and like someone else who I wrote about, this guy Matthew Prince, in the magazine story, who's the CEO of Cloudflare, who'd had his accounts hacked, and they'd actually managed to get around in a very ingenious kind of way and perhaps not even meaning to, but certainly managed to get around his two-step authentication. We're in his Gmail. And, he's talked about how violating that was for him and how he still wonders what could come out of that, something could still happen, from the time they're in there. Another friend of mine who lives in New York actually recently had his laptop stolen. And when that happened, he not only did they manage to steal his laptop, but they went into his stuff and they went into his email, and in his email they found photos that he had been sending to other people on Craigslist,
mm-hmm.
That he was meeting, and they posted naked pictures of him to his Facebook account. And so I think it's not just something that like I experienced, but like you see, getting your accounts hacked is pretty common now. And like, we have really deeply intimate stuff in our email, email has just some of our most personal moments, it might be some email you wrote to someone in your family or received from someone in your family who's deceased. It might be, a picture you never want anybody to see. It might be a picture that you hold dear, all these things that are both, you think of them as being irreplaceable, and you also think of them as being something that's just so private, but they're not nearly as private as we think they are.
And what about just the sort of response to the story? I've had this experience once where, most of the stories you do, especially you do story, you did like at least three long stories, really long stories out of this.
Yeah.
And they take a lot of work, and they're hard to write, and they go through the fact-checking process and everything else. And then most of the time, like, nobody pays that much attention to them, or they get a little feedback online or whatever.
Yeah.
But here you've got people, they want you on TV, they want you talking about this. what were you sort of embracing that? Like, all right, I'm going to go do all of this stuff now because everyone wants to talk about it. And this is like a public service to talk about it. Or at a certain point, be like, I'm sick of fucking talking about this. Getting
both.
Yeah.
You know, both. I mean, like, you know, I mean, it's kind of weird because it was like an incredibly shitty thing, but it also like was, I mean, be honest, I mean, it was good for my career, you know? You know, so I also felt like it was important and necessary to get the story publicity, to make it, to some extent, to get the companies involved with this and with the, I wrote a story with a kid in LA named Cosmo, which was, you know, involved several other companies that had security practices. He talked about how to get around those, to get people to change things, you know, to get companies that we entrust our data to do things to make that data more secure. And I feel gratified that, like, a lot of that has happened, you know. I mean, Amazon changed their policies, like, the day my first story went up. Apple, like, shut down their tech support for a while, shut down their passwords over the phone for a long time, and has recently launched two-factor authentication, which I don't think I'm solely responsible for, but I think I played a large part in making that happen. And, you know, a lot of other companies have beefed up security since that happened. Yeah. Especially as it relates to our personal data. And that's, you know, I mean, like, our personal data is so precious to us, and we don't think about it in the way that we think about, like, our bank account, but we should.
Mm-hmm. And I want to step back a little bit, because you've been writing about technology for a while. I mean, certainly since I've known you.
About 15, I don't know, but I mean, for about 15 years.
Yeah. And there's a sort of, I always notice a funny dichotomy between some of the things you write, which are, you know, if we were talking about your live blogging, the Google announcements yesterday, and writing, like, very straight, this is what's happening, like, you've got all kinds of background knowledge to bring to it, and then if you look at your Twitter feed sometimes, it looks like you're kind of like, fuck this. Like, the question I'm leaning to is, like, do you actually like technology?
I do. I mean, I do. I mean, I embrace it in a lot of ways, but I also think that that this industry, especially as it relates to, like, you know, a lot of the silly apps and the silly websites and the silly, like, shit that we put up with, you know, is ridiculous, and it's just such a hype fest. It's such a It's just so much bullshit. You know, people just live off of jargon and you know, and nonsense. And their entire conference is devoted to nonsense. You know, I'm not talking about I.O., but I mean, there are conferences that are just nonsense.
You wrote a
nonsense.
Good thing about, was it CES for Gizmodo, that was like, yeah, it's just this real, like, this is a disaster, and I feel like I'm a part of it, kind of.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, I like to skewer that stuff because I don't want to feel responsible for that. I don't want to feel like I'm making somebody run out and buy some piece of shit they don't need because they feel like this, you know, it's the, you know, I mean, I think technology is, I mean, I love technology. I'm fascinated by computers and the connections that we can make between them to improve our lives and the way that we can use all sorts of. Things that have come out of the technology industries to make our lives better and happier and healthier and more productive, and, you know, but I also think that it's, God, there's so much bullshit, and like, there are, you know, I feel like it's really easy to, like, just get caught up in that, especially places like here, probably New York as well, where the culture is so just such a hothouse of everyone, you know. I mean, I'm running around wearing Google Glass the last couple of days, you know, so it's not like I'm, you know, I mean, I'm part of the problem.
But how do you approach it in your writing? Like, what is your sort of stance vis-a-vis you? I mean, sometimes you worked at Gizmodo before coming back to Wired.
Yeah.
You have to review products. You have to. That's part of that.
Yeah, I mean, so I feel like my role is always to be a consumer advocate. You know, I wrote something about a bike that I've been riding recently, and, like, I said some mean things about it, and, like, I had a, you know, somewhat uncomfortable conversation with the press rep afterwards. And, you know, I mean, what I said to him, and this is what I honestly believe, is, like, you know, my job isn't, like, I don't want to pick on you know, some small bike company or something like that. But I mean, my job is to look at things from a consumer perspective and think about what people may want to either spend their money on, spend their time on, invest themselves in, trust, you know, that type of thing. And so if you can kind of step back and do that, and I actually think most of the better technology reporters do. Almost all of the better technology reporters do that. And, you can do people a great service, but they're such a buzz machine, you know, and you just got to try and avoid that.
And there's just a whole tech journalism industry that's at a certain level is built around like just pimping the next thing that comes out and just new.
Right.
And then there's this group of, we had Joshua Topolsky on, and like, you know, there's a group of people that sort of live above that and try to take like a critical view and do real reporting and that sort of thing. There's this sort of strange kind of like two-layer thing happening in tech reporting, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is you want to get the latest, greatest stuff and talk about it, you know, and if, because that's what people are interested in. I mean, that's what I'm interested in, you know. I mean, like, of course I want to try out Google Glass. You know, of course I do. It's new and different. And,
see, I don't feel that way, but I understand why you feel that way. I don't personally feel that way.
I enjoy new experiences, you know. Like, it's the same reason that I wanted to swim across the bay for the first time, you know, from Alcatraz. The same reason I wanted to take LSD when I was in high school. It's the same reason I, you know, like, all that stuff I think is related. You know, I enjoy new experiences and new things, and I enjoy, like, doing something for the first time and learning about it and diving into it. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying. Other than like, yeah, I want to try that stuff out. But I don't want to get caught up in like promoting it for the sake of promoting it.
Right. So 15 years covering tech. That would take us back to
basically, yeah, 98. Yeah.
How did you get started in that? Because you came, as I recall, it came like a little late to journalism in terms of your.
I was in
adult life.
Well. I came late to everything in my adult life. I mean, it took me a long time to graduate from college. Yeah, I dropped out of college a couple times.
First, we should say that you are from Georgia.
I'm from Georgia, yeah. I dropped out of college a couple times. I worked in PR for a year before. I worked in journalism. And when I was in college, like, I'd learned to build, like, not through college coursework, but I had, while I was at UGA, while I was at University of Georgia, I had started messing around with the web and like building websites and I was doing that for this PR agency I worked for a little bit, and I was doing, you know, other things like that there, and basically doing some of their high tech work. And then I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to stay in PR, and I got an internship at Mother Jones here at their website. And at the time, like, working on the web itself was like, you know, whoa, weird, you know, and I don't recall exactly. I mean, I know we weren't doing static. I think we were like at that point still like having like every story we wrote, basically we had to write it, you know, in an HTML web page and like, yeah, you know, upload it to an FTP server and, you know, somehow or another and get it on there. Like, there was no CMS. And to some extent, I got that job because I could do that, not because I was a good writer or a good reporter or anything like that, you know. And so,
I'll have you know that in 1998, I got rejected for an internship at Mother Jones.
Really? Okay.
I still have. The other day, I just moved apartments. I found the postcard. They sent a postcard saying, "You're rejected. Like, sorry, we got too many applicants. We can't give you this internship." And when I got the postcard, I remember, and I was like, "I'm going to save this postcard. Someday, I'm going to give it to the editor, Mother Jones, and be like, fuck you."
Who was it?
At the time, I have no idea who was the editor.
It was because my editor was Eric Umansky, who's now at ProPublica.
It could be. It was like 90. It would have been 98.
And it could have been. It could have been John Cook, who was
John Cook of Gawker.
Yeah.
I just need to know who to say fuck you to.
You
I'm not
go,
sure that's really applicable.
You should
though.
Go tell both those guys fuck you. Because why not?
Just on principle.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you were.
Yeah, so I was there. I mean, basically, yeah, and like, but I, you know, I wrote about tech stuff for there. Then I went to a startup that failed. Then I went to another startup that failed. And then I'm like, you know, was at Macro for a while. And then I basically dropped out again and went to Southeast Asia for a while, and then came back. And
but one of these startups that failed, I was looking back at it. Wait, what's the name of this thing?
Getting It, probably.
Getting It.
Yeah.
Getting It. I was trying to remember because you wrote about you kind of like recalled it recently in a blog post where you were just talking about something about San Francisco, working there. And then I was looking at the. the publication was like getting it a webzine.
Yeah.
And you had written like a, you know, when it shut down, you had written something. And I was trying to remember, I mean, did you, when you were working for that, did it feel like that magazine was going to last? Like, this is it. This is the new frontier. And getting it is going to be the next, I mean, Wired wasn't even that old at that point. It's going to be the next such and such. Or were you kind of like, let's just ride this. This can't possibly.
I actually was a little bit deluded enough to initially, at least for a while, at least to think it was going to be, you know, sustainable. Which it wasn't. We'd literally had no revenue plan. There weren't even any ads on the site. There was nothing, you know. But I always assumed that at some point we would put ads on the site and, like, you know, it would make money. And I think part of that was a function of, like, being, you know, sort of young and naive and, like, very wild-eyed. It was a very wild-eyed time here in San Francisco. Like, everybody was just like, oh, man, you know, I mean, business plan. You don't need a business plan, you know. And
money. Money was flowing.
Just money. Yeah.
The streets.
Like, much like it is here now. I mean, I think there's a lot more money flowing around here now than there was then. But there's not that cultural kind of, you know, oh, all the old ways were wrong and all the new ways are right. And, you know, and we're going to have a great big party and everybody come and here's some ecstasy and, you know, have a good time. That stuff kind of went away.
But did working at those places, were those just gigs that you kind of got by, or was there, in terms of your writing, sort of like you had the ability to write about whatever you want because the money was flowing?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think they were very bad for me in terms of being a writer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because both of them were like they were like you can kind of do whatever you want, you know. And I didn't have any sort of editorial oversight, you know. I mean, it was just sort of like, hey, go for it, you know. And you know, and getting it in particular, like it was. You know, I mean, we published things that, like, you know, blurred the line between fact and fiction. You know, I mean, and not that we are doing things to be, not like in a Jason Blair sort of way, where we were making things up. But we had stories that we, like, intentionally wanted to be sort of, you know, weird and out there, and could this be real? You know,
more
type
in
of thing.
Hunter Thompson sort of way.
Yeah, you know, the editor in chief is this guy. Are You Serious? Who's sort of a, you know, legendary. He was an early cyberpunk writer. He's a publisher, Mondo 2000. He, you know, he co-wrote books with Tim Leary. You know, I mean, he just actually published some Tim Leary stuff. He was definitely a. Someone who wanted to experiment, you know, and experiment with literary forms, you know, and so like in some ways that was good because it made me more, you know, more interested in what you can sort of do with language, but in other ways it was bad because I didn't really have any like oversight in terms of like, you know, this is really dumb. You should not do this. This is dumb.
And so. You, those things went away, you left for a while, bummed around, and then where did you actually land back in sort of journalism?
I was freelancing for Macworld, I was freelancing for, I was stringing for the National Journal, I was their, basically their West Coast, reporter out here. I was, for Tech Daily, which was their tech section, there I had a few other freelance things, and then but I wasn't making ends meet, and like in 2003 I think I made $12,000 living in San Francisco, you know, which was brutal. If I hadn't been married to a wonderfully indulgent woman, I would have been like back home with my folks, you know. And at the end of that year I got a freelance fact checking gig here at Wired, which got my foot into the door with writing for Wired, which, you know, I mean, worked out pretty well.
Yeah, and then you bounce at Gizmodo, and then you bounce back.
Yeah.
And with the, you've been writing these long pieces, but you wrote, I mean, I remember a piece you wrote for the magazine, actually it's kind of annoyed me because you wrote a piece about, you're using every, like, location-aware app. Which is something I kind of, like, not that explicitly, but I kind of, like, had in my mind, like, I want to do something like that. I mean, this is before Foursquare even got big.
Yeah, I remember the piece. I remember using all these, like, location things on the T-Mobile G1, like, the first Android phone, and my iPhone. I think Foursquare was out then, but yeah.
The question I was getting to actually was, do you prefer to stay in the daily mix of, you know, doing some live blogging, doing some shorter stuff, Or if you could just choose, would you just write features? I mean, a lot of people feel that way. Like they actually just want to write features and they can get to that point, they'll do it.
No, I like being in the mix. Like that's what, like, so when, so like I said, you know, I started off on the web and eventually sort of migrated to magazines and, first at Macworld and then here. And, I really love doing longer stuff and I love doing magazine work. I love it. Like, cause you get so much room to really like hone things, but I also really like being in the mix. And this is something like, Alexis Madrigal, who's a really good friend of mine and I've talked about, is that, you know, when you're in that day-to-day mix, like, I think you get a really good perspective on what's happening. You know, I mean, there's a little bit of like forest for the trees problem, but you also get a really good perspective on what's happening. You get to, you know, you have to, you know, stay really current and see what's going on. And so, like, live blogging, like at Google I/O, like, I love live, even though that was brutal, it was 4 hours, but I love live blogging because it forces you to, you know, it forces you to think quickly, forces you to, like, use whatever experience you've got about something and try and show it and give people a perspective and give it to them now, you know, like if you're just sort of reciting what's happening, nobody's going to read it. So you got to do some color commentary and some, you know, and some like added, like, here's what this all means kind of stuff in the, as it's happening. And it reminds me a lot of, like, I'm sure you're familiar with Robin Sloan's stock and flow.
Yeah. Thing. But maybe you should say a little bit about what it is.
So the stock and flow idea is that basically, and I think he wrote this a few years ago talking about Alexis actually, but, was that, the people who do really well, the writers do really well online today are people who have what he called stock and flow. And the stock is the longer form stuff and the flow is the shorter form stuff day to day. And, so to me, like that really resonated with me. And, so I try and do a lot of flow if I can, which is day-to-day news, day-to-day things on Twitter, day-to-day, you know, just of the moment kind of stuff. And then if, you know, also be working on some long form stuff at the same time. Like, I'm working on two different long form stories right now that, you know, that I'm doing sort of simultaneously while I'm trying to do day-to-day stuff.
Now, how do you do that? Like, logistically, I mean, when you get into like finishing a piece or closing a piece, it's a full-time endeavor to some extent. Are you allowed to kind of like take some time?
It's complicated. Yeah. I mean, so they're, I mean, Wired's actually really good about this. Gizmodo's really good about this, about, you know, sort of giving you the, okay, well, you know, we know you're working on this bigger thing. And so, you know, here's a little bit of time to finish that up, but it's complicated, you know, I mean, and it sort of means that you end up, you know, you end up working more than you might want, and like sometimes weird hours and things like that, you know, because like I try and, like, I, you know, I have a kid, so I try and be home at an early hour, and that might mean, you know, and do bedtime and all that kind of stuff, and that might mean that I work, you know, like I don't work from like, you know, 5 to 10, and then I work from like 10 to 2 or something, and then I, you know, and so it's a, you know, and just you make it work.
What's your relationship to competition, to other, and you're obviously like pals with a lot of people cover the same stuff, you see them, you know, whether if it's a sort of event-driven coverage, yeah, you're going to see those people. But what's your sort of your do you feel like turned on by other people chasing the same story? Do you want to stay away from other people being on the same story?
I mean, I like to. I'm not really into scoops. Like some people really, really, really want scoops. Like, I really want to break this thing about, you know, such and such. And there are a few scoops that I like to have. And like you have to get some in order to, you know, kind of do your thing. But like, I don't really feel competitive about that. Like, Jay Rosen wrote something about the hierarchy of scoops, and there's like the ego scoop. And I feel like that's what most of the scoops you see are, where, you know, it's like, oh, okay, well, I'm reporting this thing that everybody else is going to have in another 10 minutes.
Right.
You know,
I found out what's coming out that they're about to announce to the world themselves.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, like that kind of stuff is really good for traffic. But I don't feel at all competitive about that. What I do feel competitive about is I want to have like really interesting stories. If so, you know, if somebody's got like a, you know, like if I find out another reporter is working on the same story that I was working on recently, actually. And, like it made me like hurry up and publish it.
Are you an optimist about sort of, doing this kind of work, the kind of work that you do? Are you sort of say, all right, I can look out 5-10 years and see where this is all going? Or do you Like, I find myself, I have some of the, like, I always have that freelance mentality, which is like, all the stuff could go away in a second. Yeah. If you don't keep hustling, like, you're not going to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the mentality I have. I mean, I was a freelancer for 10 years, you know, and I still have that mentality. Like, I feel like I have to hustle. Like, I feel like I have to, like if I haven't had something where that's, that people have noticed recently, like, I feel like, oh, shit, I got to get something that people notice, because otherwise people are going to forget that, you know, these editors who sit 5 feet away from me are going to forget my name, you know? You know, I don't know what it means. I don't know what the future of journalism looks like in 5, 10 years. I don't think anybody does. I mean, I actually think that the atavist is a, you know, I mean, I'm not just saying this because you're sitting across from me, but like, I think that the atavist is a pretty like solid take on what things could be, you know, but who knows, you know, I mean, like, who knows, like, nobody knows. And, anybody who says they know is just wrong. And like the people who like talk the most about the way things are going to be, I feel like are so full of hot air that like, you know, that nobody knows. And like, you know, there were like a series of stories in the last 2 weeks, like, this is the best time ever to be in journalism, and this is the worst time ever to be in journalism. And like, it's not true. It's all bullshit. Like you just like, but what I do think is that, there's always going to be a market for, stories that inform and entertain. Like, there will always be a market for that. And, if you can write those stories, you will be able to be employed. Will you be able to make the same kind of living that people made in journalism 10, 20 years ago? Maybe not. But like, you know, you'll be able to, you know, like clearly like newspaper unions are a great example of something that's just, you know, been gutted. Like that kind of journalism lifestyle where you could go to work at a daily paper and have that job for 40 years and retire and have a pension and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's done. But, can you still be a storyteller who's also like in the field of public service and still be, you know, make a middle-class living and you know, you're probably not gonna get rich, but make a middle-class living and do okay. I think that's going to be around for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one question is like, what is the value of reporting in that? There's sort of like writing and storytelling, and there's so much stuff online. But then it's actually leading me to a question that I meant to ask you earlier, which is sort of, how did you learn how to report? Because a lot of people can go, you know, there's like, you can write about technology. It's out there. Like, you can get it. You can buy it. You know, finding sources, like writing about a hacker kid and convincing him to talk to you, like, that's a different type of...
Yeah, you know, well, you remember I said that in 03, the end of 03, like, I had, like, I was, like, dry and, you know, like, running out of money, and I got a job freelance fact-checking here at Wired. And that was actually one of the most valuable things that I ever did in terms of learning how to report, because I got to see the back end of some really good reporters and how they worked, you know. And so I had been a reporter at that point for several years, you know. I mean, Mother Jones had a really great learning process for, and Mother Jones had a very rigorous fact check system as well, for reporters, and you know, and I was writing for the National Journal, for Tech Daily, and like, they had, you know, a good reporting process. But seeing really, like, you know, legendary reporters, and seeing like how reporters operated, you know, and like, I would listen to transcripts, you know, and you know, that kind of thing, and like, hear how people who were, you know, who had been in the business a lot longer than I had been and were better at it than I maybe ever will be, worked. And that was like super valuable, you know. And then also quite honestly, like, Gizmodo was really, really valuable for me for being a reporter, because I wound up having to do so much. So, you know, like you just got to write a lot there. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel like even though I was pretty, you know, far along in my career there, like, as a reporter, as like a day-to-day reporter, like, just, you know, like, having to like stay on top of shit, like, just constantly, that was really, really good.
It probably wipes out any preciousness you might have also about your copy, that you just have you need X posts a day, and they also have to be good, but you can't be sitting there like churning them over and looking for the perfect word every time.
Yeah, it's true. It's definitely true. You got it. We got to get this up now, you know.
Is there any book possibility out of the hacking stuff?
I was approached. So I've got an agent, and I was actually approached by a couple other agents even. And to be honest with you, I just don't think I can write about it anymore. Like, I kind of want to close that chapter on my life.
I could already picture you on the cover, though, the photo and everything.
Oh, it'd be so appealing, right? Especially now that I've lost some weight.
Yeah, that brings us right back to the beginning. That's a perfect
There's actually nothing like having your picture in a magazine when you're, you know, 15 pounds heavier than you want to be.
Tell me about it.
To make you want to lose weight.
Seriously, you're like, oh, right. Yeah. I was in my head, it was the me of 10 years ago, but the one in the magazine is the me of 10.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, well, thanks a lot for doing this.
Also, I'm so glad you had me.
Thanks to Wired for letting us do this here. And good luck.
Thank you. All right. Good to see you.
That's it for the Longform Podcast. Thanks to Matt Honan for joining me. I'm Evan Ratliff of Atavist. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Longform. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner. And our sponsor this week was Tiny Letter. Thanks. We'll see you next week.